Breakfast puppies?
We're all set to begin, so let's dive right in to Bikers, Dice, and Bars. Talking bicycles and motorbikes, gamer things and all the like. You can listen to it in your cars, but mostly it's about dive bars. Bikers, Dice, and Bars.
Hey, Xander, what are we drinking right now?
We are drinking my absolute favorite cocktail on earth. This is a cocktail that I've wanted to bring to this podcast group since we started recording over a year ago, but it had to be today.
Why today, Xander?
Well, as we are recording this, it is the 75th anniversary of the D-Day invasion, Operation Overlord. And so there's a very special liquor that I only discovered because of my grandfather, who was a paratrooper in World War II, and it's called Calvados.
And what is this concoction?
Calvados is a really delicious apple brandy come from the Normandy region of France. It's kind of like champagne, can only come from that region. And the cocktail we are drinking with this is the Widow's Kiss.
It's very delicious.
It is quite delicious.
Made with, it is Calvados, it is green chartreuse, or yellow is traditional, but I like green better because it's less sweet. It is Dom Benedictine, and it is Angostura bitters, stirred and served up traditionally with a cherry, but I didn't bring cherries today.
That's sad. You're letting us down, man. Letting us down. Shame.
Yeah.
Shame.
But, I also like the name of this cocktail, too, because my grandfather's regiment in World War II, the 502nd Parachute Infantry Regiment, were known as the Widow Makers.
Oh.
Ooh. Wow.
This is their patch. I got it on my jacket.
Nice.
That's really
We'll definitely have
amazing.
Some pictures of that.
Yeah, they had to change it after World War II because it was deemed to be not super PC.
Oh.
Well, there was also other reasons.
Yes. In World War II, skulls on patches had a generally bad connotation.
Yeah.
Well, it was also the bat wings, and it started looking a little too Spetsnazy by about 1952.
Which is about when they changed it during the Korean War.
That reminds me of that Mitchell and Webb skit where they're in war and they start realizing, oh, wait. We have skulls in our hats. Maybe we're the baddies. Oh, by the way, you're listening to Bikers, Dice, and Bars, recorded here in Portland, Oregon. As usual, I'm NPC.
Dr. Xander Gerrymander.
Just Jacob.
Poppy Beaujolais.
And before we dive into the deeper meat of the episode, we want to give a shout out to our first patron on Patreon, Brandon.
Yay!
Yay, Brandon.
Thank you, Brandon.
He was telling us on Discord, dear listener, join us on Discord and participate in all the exciting conversations with Brandon about how he mainlined pretty much all of our episodes, including the character jams and both of our sister podcasts, too. Good job, Brandon.
Thanks, yeah. Good job, Brandon.
Yeah. He said he just binged them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're good a little, for you, dude.
We're a little worried about you, but.
Thank you.
If we ever run into you and you can prove you're that Brandon. Drinks are on us.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
I'm not worried. I'm flattered. I now have maybe two fans.
Yay. Woo-hoo.
Tin Man and Brandon in the house.
So another question I did have for you, Xander. What does the number of a legion or a unit or a regiment mean? Like you said, the 502nd. What does that number mean?
Okay. So military units for a very long time have gone and like, it's just a classification of, just to differentiate them. Like, you know, the big red ones, the First Army, you know, they, you know, there's cavalry, you have, I actually don't know the numbers actually are there for, because in the U.S. Army in World War II, you had the 82nd Airborne Division and you had the 101st Airborne Division. My grandfather was in the 101st. They were the same size. the number, I think, is just a way to, delineate between different, divisions, and they're broken down into regiments from there, and then platoons from there, and squads from there, etc. So, he was 101st Airborne Division, 502nd Parachute Infantry Regiment, Company B.
And of note, in the U.S. military system, when a regiment or division's number is retired, i.e. goes inactive, such as the Marine Corps did with the 26th after Vietnam, it's retired. And that's that. However, its legacy is held, and should they ever reactivate a unit, they can consider any deactivated unit. But if they reactivate that number, all of the symbology goes with it, all of the legacy goes with it. It is not considered a brand new, fresh unit, but a continuity all the way back to its original founding, which in some cases dates back to the War of 1812.
That's awesome.
There's only one military unit with a longer history than that.
And which unit is that?
USS Constitution.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah.
So that's kind of, I need to do more, a little more research about my great uncle then, and figure out what on earth the 733rd Railway Operating Battalion was.
So it's a rail. This one I actually can give a little insight on.
Okay.
The 733rd Operating Rail Battalion was a unit. Any rail battalion unit was basically an engineer battalion that was designed to operate the locomotives, keep the rail stock going, everything involved with the operation of railroads. They date back to, I think, don't quote me on this, the Civil War, but
that would make sense.
I don't remember whether they were ad hoc, not numbered formations at that point, but about then was when they got created. So they were a specialist engineer battalion, similar to combat engineers, similar to like in the same lineage as CBs, where they had a very, very specific task.
Uncle Winfred.
Yeah, generally not combat based, but they're there to make sure that everything else goes according to plan.
Speaking of things that go, let's take this to the road.
Nice segue.
Nicely done.
All right, so for our biker section tonight, we thought it'd be a real fun little trip down memory lane to go and talk about the history of bicycles and motorcycles in war. Because there is a fun history involving that.
Oh yeah. Tell us this history, Xander.
Yeah, so I was doing some research, and I was actually kind of surprised to learn that the first time that bicycles were used in warfare was the Franco-Prussian War.
I am not surprised.
The what now?
Franco-Prussian War of 18...
The war between France and Prussia?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I was just guessing, right?
Yep.
Yeah? Okay.
Yeah, 1870 to 1871 was the very first time bicycles were ever used in a military context. Bicyclists were mostly dispatch riders and scouts. They didn't do super well in the Franco-Prussian Wars. They kind of weren't really looked at for a little bit later. You then had, you know, Austria, Germany, and France really kind of going and looking into them a little bit harder. And France was the first one that instilled an actual bicycle military battalion in 1887. And part of the problem with, you know, some of us might know military minds are a little slow to change sometimes.
I don't know what you're talking about. Cutting edge of technology at all times, embracing new ways.
My bad. But because cavalry units were so distinguished and had, you know, super sexy uniforms, and we're just viewed to be kind of, you know, the premier of any military.
And Stetsons.
Sometimes.
Sorry.
Yeah. I mean, again, like that's, you'd bring out your cavalry for, you know, beautiful events and parades and whatnot. And there was just the most noble thing you could be in the army. So being hunched over on a bicycle in a uniform is considered to be kind of uncouth and undignified.
No.
So it was just like, well, sure, I don't have to feed a bicycle. Sure, I don't have to go and like take care of it as much as a horse, but sure, it's more efficient than a horse. But you know what? I like the horse.
Yeah.
It's ungentlemanly.
Yeah. Yeah. So as the bicycle technology kind of improved, you were able to actually have seats that made you sit upright a little bit more, which made it a little bit more palatable to people who didn't want to put bicycles in the army.
I'm just picturing a whole bunch of soldiers fully decked out in the, you know, the kits from the olden days, riding penny farthings into battle.
And little bells going off. Bring, bring,
God
bring, bring.
Damn it. I want that so bad. Just a little gun mounted on the.
Are you telling me that for Pedalpalooza, we are going to make our own bicycle battalion?
Yeah.
Cavalry?
Yes.
Bicycle cavalry?
We have to do this.
Okay.
Good doctor. We need to look up Armistice Day, and you and I have a project.
Done.
I actually know someone who was in a cavalry in Afghanistan, Iraq.
Yeah.
So, like, we can. Well,
that's coming on later.
Yeah, we can ask him.
Yeah. So the United States first it was the first Signal Corps of the Connecticut National Guard, which made the first bicycle unit for the United States in the late 1800s. And some fun things about that is that they were trying to go and prove just how well you could go and send a message via bicycle, because military won't pick up anything unless you can like prove it 10 times over that, like, no, this is actually a good idea. So they send a message from Chicago to New York City by bicycle messenger dispatch team in 4 days and 13 hours. That is a long ass fucking distance.
Oh my God.
Then later on, this is also 1890s, from Washington, D.C. to Denver in just over 6 days.
In 1890?
Yeah.
Wait, Washington to Denver in 6 days on a bicycle? Wait, Washington, D.C. Yeah. or Washington State?
D.C.
Holy God.
In teams of cyclists.
In 1890, where half the roads are corduroy.
Uh-huh.
Oh, my God.
Wait, okay, so.
Again, it was probably a relay.
Holy
shit.
It was a relay, but again, that's a fuck ton of distance to cover. And they were actually beating out actual signal teams in communicating messages.
Hold on. You broke my brain. Because I'm trying to imagine someone going across the Great Plains, you know, Kansas.
With no paved roads?
Paved Missouri. Roads, not even graded roads.
Like, what?
Yeah. So, anyways, what some of the bicycles looked like, we had the 25th Infantry Bicycle Corps of the Montana National Guard. And so their bicycles were equipped with a knapsack, a blanket roll, a tent, a rifle, and 50 rounds of ammunition. That's a pretty sweet bike, and now I want to go camping.
Okay, yeah, but I imagine firing any of that ammunition off the bike would pretty much knock it over.
Yeah. You wouldn't do that. The bicycles were basically like, once combat happened, you just hop off your bike and then go fight.
Dragoon style.
Yeah. So, I mean, World War One had some uses of bicycles, but because of the muddy Western trenches and whatnot, they weren't super efficient, except for behind the lines where, you know, things weren't muck. But speaking of D-Day, the Canadian 3rd Division stormed Juneau Beach with British BSA folding bicycles strapped to their backs.
I'm just picturing some soldiers with Bike Fridays carrying them around.
And also British paratroopers were also given the BSA folding bicycles to jump behind enemy lines with, because apparently you could cover up to 75 miles in a day on a bicycle as opposed to about 25 miles on foot. So just the sheer distance you could travel, and also... Again, there's no gasoline. There's no engine noise from these things. They're pretty damn quiet. So as long as no one's shooting at you, you could go a real long distance with very minimal effort. So that's why it was used a lot for that. After that, they were used a bit in Vietnam. They were used actually even today by some special forces in Afghanistan, which I think is fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
And my favorite thing is the last actual bicycle battalion to exist on Earth just folded in, no pun intended, 2001. The Swiss had an actual bicycle battalion for over 100 years.
Now, let's add a motor to that. What's the history of that?
Oh, yeah. Now, there's actually a lot of debate as to when the first motorcycle actually was used in warfare. It appeared to be trickled in an ad hoc fashion, but the... general consensus is that the first time motorcycles were used in an organized fashion during a military conflict was by the United States in the...
America!
Well, how appropriate, because they used it to hunt down Pancho Villa.
Oh.
Nice.
Yeah, but...
Oh, right. One of the, like, 12 times under Woodrow Wilson, we invaded Mexico.
Yes.
Wasn't he kind of a piece of shit?
Racist.
I mean, we tend not to be political on this show, but there was no excuse for Woodrow Wilson.
Fuck Woodrow Wilson. when you go and have Birth of a Nation premiered in your White House and you go and bemoan the fact that this is not the history we're going to teach our kids, you're an asshole.
Yeah.
Anyways, during World War II, or World War I, just about everybody and their cousin used motorcycles, with one exception. I could not find any documented history of the Russians deploying a motorcycle during World War One.
Interesting.
The United States fielded both the Harley-Davidson Model 17F, which I've had the privilege of throwing a leg over, however it was inoperable, and... you know, you might be purring over that, but the one that gets my heart warming is the... Indian power plug, big twin, suicide clutch.
Holy shit.
You tell me you weren't going to bring pornography to this episode.
I said no such thing, sir.
Oh my God, that's amazing.
All manner of hot and bothered now.
It outperformed the Harley and actually helped land it as a solid American brand until it finally folded as a company.
Indians are back.
Indians are back. Yes.
Native Americans,
they are
please.
Gorgeous.
During the same time, Triumph brought out, by the way, folks, I have pictures galore. I will link the article that I'm showing everyone.
Look at that uncomfortable seat.
Oh, yeah. Oh, you want to see uncomfortable. So now we're going to flash forward to World War II, just like the folding collapsible bicycles that British paratroopers were going into Normandy with. The Well Bike, a folding, non-suspended, non-mufflered,
that's a weird
collapsible, containerized paratrooper motorcycle.
I want one.
That just looks like a saddle sore with wheels.
Yeah, it does.
I would get a better seat, but oh my God, I want one.
So in World War One,
how much do those bad boys weigh? Do you know?
The stats are on the page.
Like 20 pounds or something? No.
It's got at least a 30 class of 17.
32 kilograms.
32. Yeah, they were heavy.
Okay. I mean,
containerized means you weren't carrying it when you went out of the plane. It was dropped separately than you and you found it.
Mm-hmm.
98 cc, two-stroke, single-cylinder, air-cooled, transmission, single speed.
So prior to
45 kilometers an hour max speed.
From pre-World War One through World War One, scout motorcycles were used primarily for messaging and by the U.S., but not so much everybody else, scouting. We did that based on our experience along the Mexican border and some work in the Philippines prior to that. Mm-hmm. And so we were more willing to embrace the role of the scouting bike.
Now, I want to know about those sweet, sweet German bikes from World War II.
Oh, with the awesome sidecar?
Tell me more.
So we're going to start in World War II with the first organized motorcycle unit by the Italians.
Okay.
Fine. But,
ciao. Moto Guzzis, huh?
But the reason they organized it was actually because of the Spanish use of motorcycles all over the place during the Spanish Civil War. Mm. Everybody and their cousin, all 5/6/7/9 sides of the Spanish Civil War used motorcycles.
It seems like motorcycles are a little fascist-y.
Yeah, well, you know, you'd say that, and then you know the next thing the communists are using it, like on the Eastern Front, where prior to the kickoff of the hostilities between Germany and Russia, Germany sold them the basic concept for the BMW military motorcycle, which became the Ural.
Oh, God, I love them so much. They are beautiful.
They're so great.
If you do not know what they look like, just watch Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, and that's it. Right there.
Yep. It's
beautiful.
At the dealership I'm going to be getting my scooter from really soon, they have Urals with sidecars there, and all I can do is picture a big, dumb dog with a big, stupid face with goggles on sitting next to me as I ride through the countryside on one of those things, and it's taking every bit of me to go, nope, scooter's more affordable right now. So I can get this later.
You can get a scooter with a sidecar.
I know. I know.
Anyways, during World War II and prior to World War II, the sales of the BMW got models of it and kissing cousins of it used by Germany. Actually, Poland was manufacturing some, but they didn't use them for military use. Russia had them. China was manufacturing a BMW knockoff from sold plans. BMWs were everywhere. Scandinavia had them, and they even appeared in France on both sides. However, when you think World War II, what comes to most people's ideas now is the iconic military motorcycle, the Harley-Davidson WLA. Captain America's bike, for those of you in the audience.
That is a beautiful machine.
God, that's beautiful.
You know what, though? That also looks like a saddle sore with wheels.
It is a saddle sore with wheels.
It's not comfortable.
This motorcycle did it all. It was used by medics, signalists, wire layers, scouts, and most importantly, strap a sidecar on that, drop a BAR on that, and you have a mobile gun platform.
Sure do.
550 pounds this thing is.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like it does not have any shocks.
Nope.
In the slightest.
You are riding a rigid, baby.
Holy mackerel.
So after World War II, motorcycles were used consistently for messaging, everything else, up until about the time we hit Vietnam. There was still deployment of motorcycles by almost every country in the world. We didn't use them so much in Vietnam. French didn't use them so much during the Indochina conflict. British didn't have a cause during Burma. You know, they kind of started falling out of a lot of military's use, except in very limited circumstances, with one exception.
What?
This is possibly the sexiest. Oh, and by the way, I'm going to cut for time, but folks, look up the British motorcycles during World War II. Triumph, BSA, Norton, they all had beautiful, beautiful bikes. And if you're in Portland or Oregon, the Oregon Vintage Motorcycle Association has a couple members who have working versions of World War II motorcycles. However, the sexiest military bike of all time, in this man's opinion,
it's Judge Dredd's motorcycle, right?
No.
Kawasaki KLR 650 tri-fuel bike.
No, I don't think anybody else at this table is a fan of enduro bikes.
You know, you can say that.
It looks practical.
It looks incredibly practical.
Looks comfortable.
It's not exactly an enduro. It's technically a dual sport, but it runs on gasoline.
And tears of your enemies?
Might as well.
Practically. Gasoline, jet fuel, or diesel.
I would marry that motorcycle, but I wouldn't have a one-night stand with it.
Yeah, exactly. That would be reserved for that Indian.
Well, then, sir, you know, I know how the table likes, so maybe you'd like to see the latest and greatest in military technology.
Ooh, is it another please. Indian?
Being used, as we speak,
yeah?
In Afghanistan, the Zero XXM.
Okay.
The All right. first okay. electric motorcycle. Okay. Oh.
That looks like a Transformer.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Like a Decepticon.
Yeah.
Yeah. No.
Okay, no, that's better.
No, that actually... Okay,
give us more. What's it called again?
It is the Zero XXM.
So that motorcycle, they took a... That was at a show here in town. Mm-hmm. It wasn't the one show, but it was like they were touring around showing this off as a concept a couple of years ago. And it was cool looking.
I really want to go test ride a Zero motorcycle.
Yeah. This motorcycle is currently only used by American and a couple of allied nations special forces units. It has the advantage in Afghanistan of being as quiet as a horse and working well with our mounted cavalry.
Yeah.
See, great for combat, not great for riding around a town. You don't want a completely silent motorcycle.
Probably not.
That sounds like a terrible idea.
Also, speaking of good pictures, here I have a American-made 1891 Columbia Light Roadster safety bike, complete with a fucking rifle mount.
Uh-huh. Whoa! Can I have one, Nathaniel? Can I have one?
When it comes to guns mounted on motorcycles, there have been everything from holsters for SMGs, pistols mounted to handlebars, BARs, light machine guns, and my favorite, the Russians designed a version of the Ural that had a mortar instead of a sidecar.
That's awesome.
Nice.
This is amazing. Basically, the entire center frame of the bicycle is a gun.
Yeah, it's just a rifle.
With both of these modes of transportation, and I mean, the Swiss used the hell out of the motorcycles, mostly BMWs.
And their bicycles.
And their bicycles. They used them both. All three of these modes of transportation, bicycles, motorcycles, horses, are a response to the same need for small units of troops to get around, or individuals to get around and perform scouting, relay, quick reinforcement, that sort of thing. You know, we will never get over the need of cavalry, and despite the advances we've come up with so far with things like helicopters and the Osprey, the ability to go over terrain and not above terrain is so very useful. So at this point in time, as we look towards the future, the cavalryman and woman is alive and well.
Speaking of looking towards the future, let's take this to the gaming table.
Nice.
Jacob, what is this new thing that has been poured into my glass?
Well, I could tell you, Nathaniel, but you'd have to agree to let me tell you a story.
Keep it quick.
Okay. Uh-oh.
As we mentioned at the top of the show, it's Memorial Day. It's D-Day. But just recently passed, it was Memorial Day. So, quick moment to friends.
Friends.
Also, this year, Memorial Day combined with another significant event, the culmination of Project Anthropod, which was the British/Czech resistance operation to kill Reinhard Heydrich, the person who the Germans had overseeing Czechoslovakia. And in honor of their memory, because none of them survive, Petrovka.
Okay.
It is a herbal liqueur, originally designed in the 1800s by...
Since 1807 is what the bottle says.
It is tasty.
Sure is.
I got turned on to it by several Czech acquaintances and my own aunt. And it's a very tasty beverage. People will drink it with club soda. They will drink it with tonic water in some parts of Europe. But oftentimes it's drunk with straight or with tea or with lemonade.
Well, thanks for the lesson here. This is tasty stuff.
This actually is quite delicious.
Yeah, I could definitely sip this in an afternoon. And it's definitely good cold.
Oh, and
fascinating.
And folks, of course, there'll be a picture with it. But if you're a person in Portland, $20 a bottle is a good way to go.
Oh, wow.
And that's not a sales price.
38% alcohol, too. Holy God.
So there's a reason I put the club soda in the middle of the table.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's go ahead and talk about some World War II gaming here. Now, I want to introduce this with a little bit of a statement in that normally while I'm all about talking about games and suggestions and ways to go about this kind of stuff, I got to admit, World War II is not my favorite era for tabletop gaming because, one, I'm almost always the GM. And two, I don't like Nazis. I don't like role-playing Nazis. I just don't like putting them in a story. I don't find them fascinating. I prefer my villains to be fascinating characters with realists, with relatable goals that simply happen to contradict the party.
So what you're saying is Nazis are pretty one-sided and uninteresting because they're just a bunch of fucking fascist pricks?
For the most part, I find making Nazis into game villains to be a little bit overdone, and I don't find inspiration in it. So I don't really go for that. But there are some analogs that I love doing. I mean, you know, fascist states can be interesting if their leaders are interesting, I guess.
Looking at you, Spain.
Yeah, Spain is far more interesting as villains, or at least like their government as villains, than the Nazis ever were to me. The Nazis just looked cooler.
They sure did.
What's more space Nazis? Stormtroopers or Cardassians?
Well, no, the Cardassians are space assholes.
Okay.
I would say stormtroopers in the Empire would be more space Nazis. Definitely. Especially if you get into the extended universe kind of stuff with like the secret police that the Empire had.
Yeah. What? Compnor.
Yeah. So that said, it was tough for me to come up with some ideas on my own. So I asked Reddit. I went to Reddit and said, if you could suggest me some World War II era games, because I'm not really up on my lore. So I want to quickly read over some of the suggestions that were given to me. The first one was a game by Jason Morningstar called Night Witches.
I love the Night Witches.
Yes.
Yep. Night Witches are badass. It's witches.
Yeah, it's a role-playing game where you play the Night Witches, and it's
they're so cool.
I played that once. Yeah.
It's the one the secret bombing squad.
Lady bombing squad.
Yeah,
I did play that at GameStorm one year.
Yeah, so that's one that people I think should definitely look into. Another one is one that I cannot believe I did not think of before I posted that on Reddit. Because I'm a big Savage Worlds fan, and Savage Worlds has the Weird Wars series, and they have Weird Wars 2. And Weird Wars 2 is, as this Redditor, Mersak, says, by far the best World War II setting that I've ever played. Being a Russian hunter comrade killing were-Nazis with a hunting rifle was something unique, to be frank. The fact that my group consisted of two professors, one student, one hunter, and one mason was great, too. Playing as civilian resistance fighters always is fun, no matter the setting.
That does sound delightful.
Nice.
Other games that were recommended were Blackout, which is a London civil defense game set during the Blitz. Godlike, which is low-level superpowers set in World War II.
Oh, that game is rocks.
GURPS, of course, because GURPS always has a book for it. GURPS has a World War II source book. I find that GURPS source books are great for historical information and for setting filler, regardless of whether or not you're playing GURPS. Any game can benefit from a GURPS handbook on that setting, if that's where you're setting your game.
And speaking of the Night Witches and Russia and their pretty forward-thinking and women in combat, are you familiar with the Russian Women's Battalion of Death?
Mm-hmm.
What?
I was about to mention that in reference to a game.
Well, let's get to that in a minute, but I want to finish listing off the rest of these games. Another one is one that I think Xander might be interested in. It's called The Gray Ranks. Then it's described as playing doomed teen Polish partisans.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, go on.
The game is wonderful. Yeah. I've had the opportunity to play it.
That sounds outstanding.
There's another game towards the end of the list. It's called Operation White Box. What it is, it's if you take the white box, the old standard D&D, and there was a flavor of that called Swords and Wizardry. Well, someone took that classic standard D&D rules and adapted it to World War II. Ooh. And it's called Operation White Box. And that's the end of my list. Yeah.
No, that's
a lot of recommendations for Godlike, but again, Godlike is supers, if that's your thing.
What was the one with the Polish partisan teens?
That one is called Gray Ranks.
Okay, two questions.
I don't know the game that well, so I can't tell you anything about it.
Okay, no, but here's the thing. Can you download it, like, right now?
Absolutely. Yes. I will be putting links to all of these things on our show
notes. Can we do a character jam for that tonight?
No.
God damn it.
Aww.
Not enough time tonight.
Because that sounds
get to
like
that in the near future.
It's kind of involved.
Really? Okay. That sounds like right up our alley for really getting hammered and
do
then doing that.
Now, at some point.
I agree. I think that would be fun. I would also love to do a character jam for Night Witches.
Oh, yes. Hell yeah.
Yes. Shit, I'd love to do one for Weird War 2.
Yes.
But I do want to talk about some games specifically that I have that are not necessarily set during World War 2, but they're related to it. And the first one is called Cold City.
Oh, yeah.
Cold City is a game of hidden agendas, trust, and monster hunting.
One of the most underappreciated games, in my opinion.
Like the cover.
It is one of the few games that actually gets trust mechanics into the game mechanically in a way I can jive with.
Yeah.
Also, talk about... And this is a games design thing that sometime maybe Nathaniel and I will riff on, but talk about design.
Something that we will
riffs on. Yes. But talk about designing a system of mechanics that is entirely based to drive the type of story and the setting you are, bringing forward. Hot War is also a favorite. You own it. I don't. I'm envious.
So, okay. I'm going to talk about these two games. So, Cold City and Hot War are a pair of games. They work hand in hand together. Cold City is a game that takes place in Berlin after the end of the war. Mm-hmm. As the Allies are dividing up the city into boroughs, trying to figure out who's going to control what region, a council is installed to manage this. One aspect of the council is its secret agenda, and that is to capture and contain and either destroy or research or abscond with the hidden Nazi agenda, hidden Nazi technological manifestations, the monsters, the creatures, the weapons that the Nazis made in Berlin. So all of these things have escaped, of course, because, Berlin got bombed and shit. So they're going around through Berlin. You are consisting of a team of agents, and each person on the team is a different nationality. Mm-hmm. You have the American, the Brit, the Frenchman, the German, and the Russian.
And before you think this is a conceit, this is based literally on how the occupying forces created the police force in Britain, in Berlin, post-World War II. It is this screwed up, yeah. folks.
And so your characters all have different agendas. You have your personal agenda, you have your group agenda, and you have your national agenda. And then you also have trust levels that you associate with each other. For example, you can be like, well, you get to just decide. Well, I trust Jacob at a 5. And Jacob's like, well, I trust NPC at a 2.
Really? So then I'm like, any thinking man would flip those ratings.
Well, yeah, yeah. Anyway, so if ever I am in a situation where I'm relying on Jacob to help me, then I get 5 extra dice because that's how much I trust Jacob. However, if ever I'm in a situation where I am betraying Jacob, I get 2 extra dice because I use Jacob's trust in me against him.
Mm-hmm. I like that.
However,
I really like that.
If Jacob wants to betray NPC, he gets 5 dice to betray him.
So that's Cold City. The game that takes it to the next stage is called Hot War, and it takes place in London, where it is the Cold War is strong and active, and that technology has escaped. Mm-hmm. And now you have to deal with it in post-war London.
Right.
And it's pretty rad.
That also sounds great.
So let's take this a step further, Xander, and talk about one of our mutual favorite settings ever.
Is it Iron Kingdoms?
The Iron Kingdom.
Oh my God, it is!
Now, the Iron Kingdoms has jack and shit to do with World War II, but... Yes. In the old Iron Kingdoms World Guide, which is an extremely expensive book to acquire these days because it was set during the D20 era and is long since out of print.
Just real quick, dear listener, I had no idea he was going to pull out an Iron Kingdoms book. He just said before we started recording that I'm going to pull out something that's going to make you really happy. And I went, okay. And I saw a stack of role-playing books and I just went, it's probably Iron Kingdoms.
Yeah, yeah.
Xander, this makes me ask you a question. Gun Mage for Life?
How did you know?
Because I know you like a brother, man.
So in the Iron
Kingdoms, my character I played.
In the Iron Kingdoms, in the World Guide era, and everything following it in like the whole war machine history, the city or the there is a state, a nation called Lael. Lael is basically this setting's version of France.
Mm-hmm.
Beneath Lael, to the south, is the country of Signar, which is this basically version of somewhere between a British-American colonial era. And then, to the north, is this setting's, is Kator, which is this setting's version of Russia.
Mm-hmm.
Well, at the very beginning of the World Guide era, Russia, or Kador, invaded and conquered Lael, and Lael exists in an occupied state.
Yep.
Bam. Occupied France, translate Cold City to Lael, and you can take Cold City, the mechanics of Cold City, including all the trust. Oh, and there's a nation nearby that's basically Spain.
You are not doing this to me. You are not doing this to me. You are running this fucking game.
This has been a campaign that I have literally been writing for 10 years.
Okay, quit writing. So when are we start playing running?
It? When are we playing it?
Occupied Lael, I think, is the best era.
I want to be a gun mage again. When are we playing this?
So I'd like to bring up a couple of my favorites. First of all, I want to start with a Apocalypse World hack base called The Winter War. It is not technically a World War II game. It takes place immediately before World War II. It's about the Finnish resistance to the Soviet invasion.
Hell yeah.
It's an Apocalypse World hack. It's based on the fact that the Finns lost the war, but won every single battle, and casualty counts are like something above 20 to 1 for a whole bunch of reasons. It's an amazing hack. It's one of the most detailed hacks I've seen of Apocalypse World that has not been published.
Oh, so, it's a playtest kind of hack?
The guy did it. The guy did it, and it's available. If you go to any of the main Apocalypse World sites, it's right there. You'll find it. It's free to download. Do it. It's amazing.
And it is called what again?
It's called Winter War.
Winter War.
Yeah. So...
And that sure was a winter war. Best sniper in World War II was Finnish.
Sniper. Interesting you should mention that, because now we're getting back to the reason Jacob has so much gray in his beard and hair. It's because
you've seen too much shit.
It's a beardy little grognard at heart in many ways. Sniper. It was a tabletop board game. It's all about snipers. And I had the privilege of ordering a copy. There were many different scenarios, everything from World War One through the French occupation, scenarios where you were playing resistance to eliminate, and most importantly, the Siege of Leningrad.
Yes.
You just reminded me of a game that I cannot believe I forgot. It's a video game, and it's one I've actually been kind of toying around with in the last couple months. It's 10 years old, and it is called The Saboteur.
Ooh. I've always wanted to play that because it looks great.
It is essentially Grand Theft Auto style play, but in Nazi occupied France.
Oh,
you play an Irishman who is being brought on by the French resistance to help kick the Nazis out of town. And as the game starts. Okay, first off, there's a lot of titties in this game. Like, there's a censoring, and you get to choose when you start the game. It might as well just say titties or no titties. And of course, titties. But
always.
Question. Yeah. Why are there so many titties?
Because it starts in a brothel, I guess.
Okay. It's like not like full of rape.
France
and shit.
In the 1940s. No, like I don't know. Yeah,
it's full of like brothels and like can girls.
Sex
like,
workers.
No. Okay. Okay. Okay.
Sex
okay.
workers.
Gotcha. Yeah. Just checking.
Yeah.
Content warning.
Yeah. It's there's sex workers in this game.
Okay.
Anyway, the game starts off with you're in this brothel and you're being brought into the resistance. And then everything outside of the brothel is in black and white. The brothel, the inside of this cabaret is in full color. Everything outside is in black and white.
Fascinating.
As you start doing missions and kicking out the Nazis, the city slowly becomes in color.
Excellent.
Oh, that's kind of fun.
And it's a lot of fun just running around like Grand Theft Auto style, just whacking Nazis. Because I don't like playing Nazis as bad guys when I'm running a tabletop game, but I can certainly shoot some Nazis in a video game.
100%.
Yeah.
Which comes to one of my favorite World War II video games. And this is for personal reasons, but also because I really like the game mechanics of it. And that is, have either of you played the Brothers in Arms series?
So that was about the time Jacob had a checkout of gaming on computers. But yes, I've seen that. I love that. If you want to go onto YouTube and look up gamers, that's G-A-V-M-E-R-S. They do documentaries on video games, and their documentary on that particular game is
Brother in Arms.
Brother in Arms is phenomenal.
So I love Brothers in Arms because of the fact that it actually follows my grandfather's regiment. I believe it's F Company of the 502nd Parachute Infantry Regiment. They made every character in the game. Every character in the game is a actual soldier who fought with that company.
That's pretty rad.
Mm-hmm. They did so much research into aerial footage to go and recreate how it looked on the ground at the time of D-Day, at the time of Market Garden. And just to like make you feel like a total son of a bitch, at the end of every mission, if someone dies that didn't actually die in real life, the game lets you know. It goes, do you want to replay this mission and not have this guy die who didn't actually die at that time?
So I just want to run through a couple lists here. Squad leader. If you're not a person who's ever played it and you like war games, play squad leader. Also, look up some of the Delta Green stuff. Some of the Delta Green stuff offers retro Cthuloid super spy, not super spies, but spy action during World War II.
And one last thing I'll say about the Brothers in Arms series that I thought they did so well is that to make a realistic combat situation, if you're a squad leader and you're trying to give out orders, it's really hard to do that in a first person shooter because you just like the mechanics just suck for it by and large. This game let you go, pause the game, go into an aerial view, allow you to go and give your squad like commands to do, then go back into first person shooter view. And that to me was such a cool and unique thing that I had not seen before.
Let's see. What have we had? We've had the Widow's Kiss.
We have had the Widow's Kiss. We have had
Petrovka.
Petrovka.
From the Czech Republic.
Which is quite delicious. And so I'm going to go over real quick a bit of history involving Calvados in my family.
As long as you promise me one thing, sir.
Mm-hmm.
The Widow's Kiss, you and I know literally practically off the top of our heads how to do a Widow's Kiss.
Yes.
However, the audience out there are not.
Oh, yeah. Let me tell you about it. Good call. So how I make a Widow's Kiss, I'll tell you the traditional recipe and how I make it. It is 1.5 ounces of Calvados. It is, I believe it's 1/2 ounce each of yellow chartreuse and Dom Benedictine. However, I think Dom Benedictine is very, very sweet. I think yellow chartreuse is very, very sweet. I don't like sweet cocktails. So I swap out the yellow chartreuse for green chartreuse and up it to about 3/4 ounce. And I keep the Dom Benedictine at 1/2 ounce. You put that into a stirring vessel, a couple dashes of Angostura bitters, stir it for about 30, 40 rotations, serve it up in a martini glass with a delicious cherry as a garnish, and you are good to go.
Any thoughts on cherries, sir?
I'm a big fan of the Bordeaux cherries myself.
I am very, I prefer for this one to pull out one of the Bada Bings.
Oh, sure.
Because the Bada Bing, if you are a little bit messy with it when you pour it in, even though you're adding more sweetness via the syrup,
sure,
it tends to blend together the flavor levels.
I can see that.
Personal preference.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Again, I like to go with the Bordeaux because it's named after a French region, and both Dom Benedictine, Calvados, and Chartreuse are all French products. Which ties into D-Day.
Tell us more, Xander.
So my grandfather, his name was Amos Almeida. His name was actually Amador Almeida. I didn't find out until years later. He was a first generation American. His parents, my great grandparents, were from Mexico, and my great grandparents sent 3 of their sons to go fight for this country in World War II, and they got 2 of them back. My grandfather was drafted into the army in February of 1942. He volunteered to be a paratrooper because they paid twice as much money. $100 a month versus 50. Sure, whatever that is, paratrooper, fine. And so
he jumping out of a perfectly good airplane.
Something I will never do is jump out of a perfectly good airplane.
A certain kind of crazy is what they said to be a
right?
paratrooper.
The airplane's flying just okay.
It's point A to point B. I do not jump out of a perfectly good airplane.
I'm perfectly good right here.
Perfectly good airplane.
So he trained for 2 full years before D-Day. And so he jumped at the 1 o'clock in the morning, whatever it was on June 6th, about 5 or 6 hours before the actual beach landings. And he went and he fell into a stagnating pool of cow shit and salt water. Because of the field that he jumped into, had the Germans stopped bilging out the salt water. It was a cow pasture. And, he jumped at about 400 feet, which is remarkable. He didn't die.
But he jumped early. That shows remarkable conviction to the plan.
He jumped. The plan to take such evasive maneuvers that's why it jumped at that altitude.
Ah.
And he estimates that's how the altitude he jumped at based on how fast he hit the ground.
Wow.
And so the fact that he fell into a stagnating pool of salt water and cow shit is why he didn't break both of his legs on impact.
I'm going to add a quick historical note and then back to you, sir. If you have ever seen the television series Band of Brothers.
I actually watched it with my grandfather.
Which is amazing.
Wow.
Part of the reason. So your grandfather was going in on the same wave that Easy Company was.
Mm-hmm.
And so jumped early because so many planes were getting shot out of the air.
Yeah.
And they were just dumping people early.
They're like, fuck it, we'll do it live. So he jumps, he gets caught in this pool for 10 hours.
Oh, my.
And that's how he developed the Widow's Kiss.
God damn it.
So he loses his rifle, gets shot at for 10 hours. He finally gets out, gets to a farmhouse.
I need a drink.
Yeah, but the Allies are also told, you know, be cautious with the French because of the Vichy French, mm-hmm. which is fair. And so he says, in my best French, they ask what I need, and I say, liquor.
Hell yeah.
And so the farmer goes and pulls out a bottle of what he calls Calvados. My grandfather's never heard of Calvados. He's Mexican from Southern California. And so he goes, well, you drink this first, and then I'll drink it if it's not poison.
Yeah.
The farmer takes a shot, and he grabs the bottle, and him, the four of the guys that he's with, go and finish this fifth and go take a nap. And then he says, then we go off to fight the war.
Holy shit.
And so I had only heard of Calvados because of this. It's not super popular in the States. Obviously, in France, it's more well-known. And I always thought, like, huh, I want to try this at some point. And also, I don't even know what kind of a cocktail this would go into. And I was looking up Calvados cocktails, and the Widow's Kiss came up. And I thought, well, that's fascinating because my grandfather's regiment nickname was the Widow Makers. And I thought, this is just kind of fortuitous. And so I put the cocktail all together, and I tried it, and it ended up just being my favorite cocktail I've ever had in my entire life. It tastes like Golden Fall.
What was your grandfather's name again?
Amos Almeida.
To Amos.
All hail the glorious dead.
Yeah.
I understand that you got to go to Normandy with your grandfather, right? On a tour?
I did. I went to every place that he fought at back in 2008.
Did you manage to find that family and that house?
We got what we were pretty sure was close to the farmhouse itself. However, during the Battle of Carentan, which was 6 days after the D-Day invasion, there was a farmhouse that my grandfather helped take in the first and last bayonet charge in world history. Was a bayonet charge across a cabbage patch into withering machine gun fire. And he took part in that, crazy son of a bitch. And that farmhouse still stands. So we went to that farmhouse, and the French farmer who was there, his father owned the house during World War II, and there's still bullet holes and all of this in it.
Oh,
In the house, and like a whole plaque dedicated to Lieutenant Colonel Robert Cole, who led the bayonet charge.
Who, for some reason, I was thinking was a relative of mine, but turns out not to be.
Yeah, he's actually a Medal of Honor recipient because of that bayonet charge.
My dad and my brother are both named Robert Cole.
Yeah, I was like, well, maybe.
You could be. I don't know.
My cousin is into a lot of genealogy, and after Xander was posted that on Facebook, I was like,
what?
Kind of looks like me, but then again, Coach Generic White Dude, so, you know.
Yeah. So we meet this farmer there who's the son of the guy who was there during World War II, and we mentioned Calvados, and he gets super excited, and he goes and he runs down into his basement, and he pulls out this like bottle of scotch and a bottle of wine with the labels ripped off, and he's like, Calvados, and he hands them over to us. And we, like, my grandfather had wanted to have Calvados when he went back to France, from day one. He's like, we gotta find a Calvados stand. I want Calvados. We're like, yeah, dude, whatever you want, like, you liberated this fucking country, it's fine. And so we went to a really nice Calvados stand, and he's just like, eh. We like got him like some like 10-year age Calvados, and he's like, eh.
But this farmer.
We get this moonshine Calvados from this farmer from the farmhouse that he took.
Right.
Clearly has a still in his basement. And
amazing.
We get back to the hotel room, and we open up these bottles, and the room just instantly reeks of apple turpentine.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
And so we go and we pour shots of this.
Yes.
And I take a shot and I just go. And like my sister can't even like do it. My grandpa takes a shot and just goes.
Calvados.
He goes, that's the stuff.
Nice.
That's what I remember. And this stuff was, this had to be like 120, 130 proof. This stuff was vile. And so.
Beautiful, you mean?
We couldn't possibly drink the rest of this during our time there. So I had flown over with 5 100-milliliter bottles because I wanted to drink on the airplane on the flight over so I could pass out.
Hell yeah.
And so I still had these bottles with me. And so in our really bougie French hotel room on the way back, you know, on our last night, I'm like pouring the rest of these moonshine Calvados bottles into these 100-milliliter bottles so I can take them back to the States with me.
Yes. Yes.
And every D-Day I would toast with them, you know, with a friend that had a particular interest in D-Day and in my grandfather's service. But I kept the very last shot for when he died. And so we went and we poured it over his ashes when we scattered them in California.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's amazing. Awesome. I mean, I'm sorry he died, but that's a wonderful story.
Once again, and this time, not to Amos. What was his birth name?
Amador.
Amador.
Amador Almeida.
Ding.
Like so many.
Salute.
Like so many immigrants who serve this country, a toast.
Indeed. Indeed.
What are some other interesting beverages from the World War II era?
Do you want to go first? You're so excited.
Ah, oh, the suffering bastard.
Yes.
Tell us. Oh, okay. This sounds amazing because I like suffering and I like bastards.
The suffering bastard was an actual honest to goodness cocktail that was conceived of only because of World War II. It was during the Allied campaign in Northern Africa to cut, you know, try to go and root out the Germans, specifically around Cairo in Egypt.
The Germans.
During the Battle of El Alamein, and as General Rommel was tightening the noose around Egypt, the Allies had, or the British in particular, had fewer and fewer supplies coming into the city. In particular, because they're soldiers, they like to drink, and so the liquor started to go bad, and it just ended up not being a good situation for them. So this bartender in this swanky hotel was like, okay, well, I'll take the shitty liquor that you guys have and I'll make it into a really good cocktail for you guys because I'm a good person. And so the cocktail ended up being what he just called the suffering bastard, because why wouldn't you?
What does it consist of?
It is 1 ounce of gin, 1 ounce of brandy, 1/2 ounce of lime juice cordial, 2 dashes of Angostura bitters. You shake that all up, pour it over rocks, and you top it with ginger beer. And nice. It was used as a hangover cure because of how fucked up the British soldiers were getting on shitty liquor in the city when they were fighting against the Germans.
What on earth is a lime juice liqueur?
Lime juice cordial. I am actually unsure. It's probably one of those. Cordial. Do you know what that is, Jenkins?
Lime juice cordial.
A cordial made out of lime juice? I've never seen it in a liquor store. It seems like it's one of those things that might have been lost to history.
Interestingly, that's a great segue to what I have. NPC asked about cocktails from World War II.
Well, I asked about drinks.
Drinks.
Cocktails. Let's go with that. Yeah.
Let's go with drinks. So there was this thing during World War II. It was called the British Navy.
What kind of a drink is that?
Well, no. It was
if this, I walk into a bar right now force. And say, pour me a British Navy, what am I going to get?
This is more of a horror story than a drink.
Does it involve scurvy?
Yes, actually. So originally, because there were so many Americans in England and so many English soldiers in England ahead of D-Day, it really strapped the liquor supply of all of England, literally. I mean,
thanks, U-boats.
Thanks, U-boats. But, well, I mean, it had more to do with the fact that, like, unless you were key to the industry, you were in arms. And sure. So Britain built 2 ships that eventually ended up serving in the Pacific that were converted. One of them dated back to World War I military ships that were floating breweries.
Yes.
Oh my God.
That sounds like the best thing ever.
Why couldn't I get drafted during World War II?
The beer was supposedly just absolutely horrible.
the best you would expect from a ship.
And the ship was bicycle powered, right?
No, because it had a cinema and dance hall.
They had to pedal real hard.
Wait a second. So there was a floating cinema hall, dance hall,
brewery.
Fucking brewery. Like, how have McMiniman's not done this yet?
This used to exist on the Willamette.
They did not have a spare antique World War I dreadnought floating around.
But can
we find one? We should make this happen.
Can we make this McMiniman's if you're looking to sponsor our podcast
and create a World War I dreadnought floating brewery?
We'll christen that one for you.
Yeah.
Yes.
We're going to come up with a list of good names. So, dear listeners, right now, please tweet or come to Discord. Let us know what names that you think should go on the very first ever Biker's Dice and Bar / Big Moonman's Crossover Pleasure Barge.
I think the Los Calvados or whatever is, what's that booze called?
Calvados.
What was it? Almador?
Almador.
We should call it the Almador.
The Almador.
I just won. You don't need to tweet anymore.
Senor.
No, actually.
Almador.
Xander, you and I need to retreat to a cabin in the woods with an insanely large liquor supply.
And I like this plan already.
I'm like, whatever else you're going to say, I'm pretty much going to say yes.
I'm not sure. We're going to develop a list of cocktails that are named after all of our grandfathers.
Okay, hold on. I volunteer. I will come to be the one who taste tests them. Therefore, you guys don't have to get totally trash and you can do science.
On day two.
If you're still alive.
My liver has survived far worse things.
Okay, I've discovered via the internet that a lime cordial is more or less like the lime version of grenadine.
Oh, okay. That one makes sense.
Roses makes one.
Ooh.
So far worse things, you mean like a crown apple?
Well, I mean...
Xander's having flashbacks. So,
little bit...
Okay.
We are going to part the curtain now. We're going to part the curtain now. Both Just Jacob and Dr. Xander Gerrymander have a wide scope of cocktails. We've kind of agreed between ourselves that Just Jacob will be the keeper of the college drinks because that's where Just Jacob worked a lot more.
That's fair. I did, however, once create a World War II themed cocktail called Operation Baytown.
Ooh, tell me more.
So Operation Baytown was the British operation to invade Italy.
Exactly.
And so it is, I use Beefeater Gin, British, against Italian Campari.
Ooh.
I mix lime juice, simple syrup, shake it, serve it up, and then top it with a few dashes of lavender bitters.
I'm going to have so...
Looks like a...
You had me until you had the lavender bitters. Goddamn.
I'm going to have so many notes of things that I have to write down for this. Thanks, guys.
Suck it up and deal.
No, the lavender bitters give it a beautifully aromatic nose.
I agree.
No, it's lavender. No.
So here's what we're going to do. I am right now in this moment challenging you both to a 4th of July cocktail competition. And I think that you two gentlemen should make these cocktails at our party.
Just so you know, these colors don't run.
This is the last call for alcohol this evening. Drink up, and order again. This is the last call for alcohol, get going. Drink up, then order again.
I'm sorry, what was that, Poppy?
I'm so drunk.
These have been some strong concoctions of what he's been drinking this evening. So let's do something that we keep forgetting to do and check in on the beverages. What do you all think of these? I know what Xander thinks of the Widow's Kiss. What about you two?
The Widow's Kiss is one of the first cocktails I learned to make.
What?
Okay, so...
What? That is so weird.
Okay, just hold up.
Okay, this is story time, but this is review time, not story time. Okay. So what do you think of it?
I happen to love the Widow's Kiss. Okay. I happen to love the dab hand with which Dr. Xander Gerrymander constructed this one.
Thank you.
It was a solid presentation. The only thing I can fault the good doctor on is failing to bring the cherry.
I know, but that
is a logistical issue that we as a podcast have to overcome rather than his failing as a man.
Don't we have like two jars of cherries
in our
fridge?
They're like a year old.
Well aged.
Yeah. No, we disposed of those.
Okay.
Poppy, what did you think of the Widow's Kiss?
I really like the Widow's Kiss. It's a little hot for me in that it is...
Pure alcohol.
100% alcohol. It's a little hot for me, but I generally really enjoyed it.
This is now my number two.
Number two favorite cocktail? Yep.
What's this is number one,
Manhattan.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Yeah. So listeners, and I must say it's this good.
That I know a bar in this town that makes the best Manhattan you've ever had. It's about $30. It's really good.
Which Holy bar is that?
It. No, I'm no, not no. going to mention it on the air.
Wait. How would a listener?
It is a small. It is a small, quiet bar that I do not want filled with assholes.
So at what pledge level on Patreon would a member have to know to get to know what level it is?
We'll talk about it in a bit. However, I am definitely, I'm loving this drink. I could sip this just like I sip a Manhattan. I can make this drink. The first one that you poured was very strong, and I wanted to get it down so I could get to what I knew Jacob was bringing next. However, the drink that you poured afterwards, Xander, I could drink this for about an hour.
Yeah.
It's a nice sipping beverage.
It's a beautiful sipping beverage.
I could drink it, and it's now my number two, because you will never be able to top a Manhattan. It is the perfect flavors for me, personally. This is very close.
That's maybe a very good sipping beverage.
Maybe if there was a cherry in it, I would reconsider that.
Sure. I'll make it for you again with the cherry.
Okay. Gentlemen's agreement. You're not allowed to bring the widow's kiss to the 4th of July.
Hold that. Hold that face. Hold that face there, Xander.
Wait, Jacob. Hold that face so I can take a picture.
That's not static. That's Xander exhaling.
Make that face again, Xander.
So, Jacob, real quick, what's the story of why you learned the widow's kiss first?
Oh, so it, very simple. Despite the fact that I spent a lot of time.
How is it simple?
Very simple. I spent a lot of time.
Stop interrupting him like I just did.
God damn you.
Just Jacob spent a lot of time bartending in college bars. And
hence my confusion.
Well, right. But when Just Jacob was not bartending in college bars.
Or speaking about himself in the third person.
Because Just Jacob deserves the third person.
Oh, okay.
It's not the third person we need, though. It's the third person we deserve.
Exactly. Oh. Not wrong. When Just Jacob was not tending college bars, Just Jacob was tending railroad bars. And in the upper Midwest, many of the people who worked on the railroad
had a fine taste for weird French liqueurs and cordials and brandies.
We're World War II vets.
Ah, okay.
So, yes.
I'm going to shut my goddamn mouth right now.
Just Jacob learned how to make things like the Crownberry, which offended the good doctor for good reason, but also learned how to appreciate a Star Anise and soda, Star Anise, the Widow's Kiss, the French 75.
That makes sense.
You know, it was all of these classic Prohibition and pre-prohibition cocktails and World War II classic cocktails. And so on one hand, I am the keeper of the lowest of the low, but I can hang
highest of the high. Interesting.
So this is why, folks, upcoming, if we get enough people backing us on Patreon, the entire podcast has agreed as of now to a Mad Dog 2020 tasting.
Fuck yes.
I will simply sit back and record that one. But one thing that we have agreed to for Patreon is that if you back us at any level, we're going to start talking about some of the places that we won't talk about on the air, but we'll mention them on our Patreon campaign for people who are invested enough to contribute to us paying the bills. These are places that we frequent, that we love, that we think are some of the best places in town in the general Portland area that we don't want filled up with assholes.
Right.
Yeah.
Also, too, on the Patreon, if we get to a certain level, we will also be doing quarterly, we will buy you the first round meet and greets.
Yep.
At one of these bars that we're talking about.
We have a Patreon. We have some various places online where we would love to interact with you. We have a Twitter, we have Instagram, both Breakfast Puppy and Instagram, and Dr. Xander Gerrymander over here has a very active Instagram of his own.
I sure
Poppy
do.
Beaujolais takes a lot of pictures of that damn chicken. And
selfies.
Jacob does nothing. So.
What do you want? I'm the old man of the podcast. I don't understand these web things.
Old man yells at clouds.
Bullshit.
I sit in my rocking chair and scream at the people on my lawn.
That's what I do a lot, too.
This out. You've been listening to Biker's Dice and Bars, recorded here in Portland, Oregon. As usual, I am NPC.
Dr. Xander Gerrymander.
Just Jacob.
Poppy Beaujolais.
And again, we wish to remind you.
Shiny side up.
Always tip your bartender.
May your dice always roll criticals.
Always drink responsibly. And always thank your veterans.
Always thank your veterans.
Thank you, veterans.
Always thank your veterans.
Cheers, guys.
Cheers.
To friends who are no longer here.
To the glorious dead.
To glorious dead.
Thanks for joining us, friend. We've reached the end of Bikers, Dice, and Bars. Talking bicycles and motorbikes, gamer things and all the like. You can listen to it in your car. But Bikes, Dice, and Bars.
Yep.